Welcome to the Artist Mother Podcast, featuring interviews with incredible working artists who are also mothers and compelling conversations regarding parenting and the art world. These conversations create a space for inclusivity and support for artist mothers worldwide. I'm Kaylin Butine, painter, mom of three, and podcast host. I'm so grateful you are tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
The kind of main thing that I hope readers will remember from reading this book is that the world needs the work that only mothers can make. If we really believe that art has the power to change the world, change minds, move people on a deep level, then the world and our communities need art that's made by those who spend most of their time staring at and caring for the vulnerable ones of this world. And that when mothers are absent from the making of culture, the world loses that unique perspective.
I'm thrilled to welcome the writer Catherine Ricketts to the Artist Mother Podcast today. Catherine writes about the arts, grief, joy, and spirituality. She studied writing at the University of Pennsylvania and holds an MFA in nonfiction from Seattle Pacific University. Her essays have appeared in literary and arts journals like the Kenyon Review Online, Image, and Plowshares. While writing, she has supported the work of other practicing artists as a live arts presenter, having held jobs at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, Philadelphia's Fringe Arts, and the public radio station WXPN. Ricketts now works at Villanova University and lives with her family near Philadelphia. And the real reason I'm having Catherine on this podcast, other than she is a writer and a lovely person, is that she wrote an amazing book called The Mother Artist: Portraits of Ambition, Limitation, and Creativity. This is a book that I shared with Catherine before we started recording, that I have been handing out to all of my artist parent friends in what feels like droves. So, Catherine, I'm so happy to have you on to talk about this book and just to share in conversation about the artist mother experience and how you wrote this, why you wrote this. Let's talk all things artist mothers. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks, Kaylin. I'm so happy to be chatting with you.
Yes. So let's just dive right in and focus on this book. And I think, you know, using the book as our guide, we will find out lots more about you and why you wrote this book and what your interest is. So I'm just like curious to start us out. Why this book? Why the Mother Artist book? What was your inspiration as a writer, but not necessarily a visual artist, to write a book about visual artists who are mothers?
I was working at the Philadelphia Museum of Art as the coordinator of their music series. And I held that job in the year that I was pregnant and had my first child. And I had always known how few women artists kind of made it into the collections of major encyclopedic museums like the Philadelphia Museum of Art. But as I entered into motherhood, I started to notice how few of those artists that did make it into the canon, we could say, are mothers. So if you ask most people who are the women artists that they know of, they would name Georgia O'Keeffe, Frida Kahlo, maybe Mary Cassatt. And very few people can come up with anyone besides those three. And as I began to look into this, I learned that none of those three women had children. And for different reasons, it was a real disappointment of Frida Kahlo's life that she wasn't able to carry a pregnancy to term. Early letters between Alfred Stieglitz and Georgia O'Keeffe indicate that she maybe wanted to have children, and he discouraged it. He said, "Your paintings are our children. We would drown if we had kids."
relatable.
Yeah. And then Mary Cassatt decided early on that her artistic ambitions were not compatible with motherhood or really family life, mm-hmm. even though she spent so much of her artistic energy painting women and children. Mm-hmm. But just knew that the demands of family life would limit her and her artistic ambitions. So learning that about the biographies of these women giants in art mm-hmm. history just made me so curious about what is uniquely incompatible mm-hmm. about a visual art practice or an artistic practice of any kind with motherhood. And I think historically, to rise to prominence in any discipline as a mother is difficult. Mm-hmm. But I think art exists in an economy all their own. Mm-hmm. And so what are the economic factors and what are the other factors that lead to this incompatibility? But then also, like, I was convinced that motherhood and artistic practice have to be mutually enriching too. Mm-hmm. And so I really wanted to explore both of those things. What are the tensions and what are these unique compatibilities?
Yeah, I think in some ways I'm like, little does society know that these things are actually can work really well together, you know? Yeah, but I think for me, it's not only the unseen and undervalued labor that goes into both of those identities. Yep. It's just so hard to bear, you know? It's also, you know, the personal weight of both of those identities. Like, artists think about the fact that they're artists a lot. You know, like, I don't think other careers quite have, I mean, in Western culture, like, we're very driven by, like, our career identity, but there's just, like, this processing that's, like, always, like, what is the point of all this? Why do we do this work? What does it mean to be an artist? Can I call myself an artist yet? Like, there's all this, like, internal dialogue yeah. that happens when you carry the artist identity. And then similarly for, like, when you become a parent, you're just like the space between yourself and existential mental crisis, like, just becomes a lot, like, the veil becomes thinner, right? You're just like, wow, like, there's a lot that I really need to think about in terms of what kind of human being I want to be, what kind of human being I want to raise. What's the point of all this, you know? So,
because they're both really hard. Like, yeah.
They require so much of you. I think that's the hardest part.
And they give back so little sometimes.
Yes. They give back so little that can be, like, quantified. I feel right. like what they do give back, so many of us would say, far outweighs. And, like, it's, like, priceless, right? Yeah. But at the same time, your moments of, like, recognizing that and sitting in the, like, holy crap, this experience is just priceless. That doesn't happen very often, you know? You're just in the grind of motherhood and of being an artist. Mm-hmm. So there's just like so many similarities in terms of the ways in which, like, the gauntlet that you go through as a person when you're grappling with both of these identities. And yet they're so compatible, like the flexibility, the patience, the willingness to, like, be okay without an answer. I feel like that desire to control and to have this perfect outcome, you know, thank God that I have learned that some of that is just not possible because of my artistic career, because you can't treat kids that way, you know, unless you're just going to parent through the lens of fear. Like,
yep. The other compatibility that became so clear to me was the artist's ability to pay attention and like just really look at the world. And how much our children just require us to look at them. I mean, the number of times that my 3 and 5 year old in a day say, "Mom, look at me.
Yeah.
Mom, you're not looking. Yeah. Mom, look."
I just said on my way to dropping my kids off to school this morning, I said to Zeke, my youngest, "You can just ask me. You don't always have to address me by name." Because I get so like, "Mom, mom, mommy, mom." And like, they wait for you to say yes. Like, I'm listening. And then they go into their thing. And I'm like, just say it. Like, you don't, because which part of me is like, really, Kaylin, you're that exasperated that you can't just say, "Yes, I'm listening." But seriously, sometimes in the moment, I'm like, just say the thing. Like, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, that attention is just so, that need for attention, I should say.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's so essential to both of these vocations.
Yeah.
To be able to stop and to slow down and to look and listen. And now I have an infant again. And
yeah. How old are your kids, Catherine?
I have a 5-year-old.
Okay.
A 3-year-old and a 2.5-month-old.
Amazing. Yeah. You're really in it.
Oh, yes. Yeah. But with sweet little girl, I just want to stare at her face all day.
Mm-hmm. And you probably should, because what better way to spend your time?
Yeah. If only it weren't for these other two kids constantly telling me to look at them.
True. Although you want to stare at their sweet little faces too.
But, I know, they're all just so damn beautiful.
My youngest is 6, so I'm
a little further ahead.
Yeah. I don't get to say that very often. Or maybe I'm just older than I forget. I'm like, "Oh wow, I'm past that stage already. That's crazy." Okay, I want to know, because I feel like my experience of building this community, of doing all these interviews, of claiming this artist mother identity has been one of, on the one hand, I was so alone. I didn't think anybody was like me. I didn't know anybody who was doing this. And if I did, I didn't know them very well. And like this isolated experience. But the minute the door opened, I was like, "Whoa, there's hundreds of you. They're everywhere. Artist mothers are everywhere. It's amazing." So I'm curious how you decided on who to feature in this book, because I'm overwhelmed with the possibility of how many people I could interview on this podcast. It's like I could record 8 interviews a day and still not touch, you know, how many artist mothers there are who are making amazing work, like in both, you know, contemporary art, let alone to talk about folks who've gone before. So how did you kind of start with that in terms of who you wanted to talk about and discuss within the book?
There were a lot of layers of consideration there. One was I wanted there to be a few bigger names so that someone picking up the book would say, "Oh,
Alice Neal.
I love them. I would love to learn more about them."
Right.
But then I also really wanted to make sure that there was an experience of discovery for the reader.
On one page you have Ruth Asawa, and then the next page you have Madeline Donahue, who's a contemporary
artist. And that's not to say that I discovered Madeline Donahue.
No, but
to say that I hope that readers would walk away saying, "Oh, I learned so much about these amazing artists that I didn't know of before."
Right.
I also, it was very important to me that very different experiences of motherhood were represented in the book. I wanted to make sure there were women from different racial backgrounds, different family structures, so single mothers and mothers with partners, people with lots of resources, people with very few resources when it comes to money, and then different mediums within the visual arts. And then also the book features writers and dancers and floral designers, filmmakers. So I had, as I mapped out the book, and I had like a big visual storyboard on the wall of my office, I was very conscientious about the balance of the book. And then the final consideration was, I really wanted to do what you have done with this podcast so beautifully, which is to give the reader a sense of their place in a really beautiful community. And in order to do that, I interviewed a lot of women in my community. So I wanted it to feel like hyper local in some way. So I interviewed a lot of Philadelphia artists who are working today. And some of them are my really good friends. And some of them I kind of met through friends of friends as I was writing the book. And hopefully, because it's a first person narrative, the reader through me feels this sense of connection and that they're not alone, to your point. There is this amazing community of women doing this work and doing it all really differently from one another. So just to expand our imaginations for what's possible.
Awesome. Let's meet up in New York City next spring for an artist caregiver exhibition. I'm thrilled to share that Artist Mother Podcast is partnering with Visionary Art Collective, and we will be bringing an exhibition by artist caregivers to Warren's Contemporary Gallery in New York City. The title of the show will be called Those Who Tend. Let me read you the statement. These days, we have so much to tend to, countless demands that deserve our attention. Our art practice needs nurturing, our children need feeding, our gardens need weeding, and our inboxes need clearing. We are pulled in so many directions, tending to various aspects of life. Yet the most important tending we often overlook is towards ourselves. This call is a reflection for, quote, those who tend, an invitation to submit work created amidst the challenges of balancing a life full of responsibilities. Artist parents who are juggling their art practice, careers, domestic tasks, caregiving, and carving out time for self-care are invited to submit their work. So if you're listening to this podcast, that's probably you. I would love to see your submission and possibly see your work if selected next spring, 2025, in April at Warren's Contemporary in Brooklyn. This show will run for 6 to 8 weeks, and the exhibition will be promoted through social media on the Visionary Art Collective platform. All pieces will be featured on the Artist Mother podcast platform. Warren's Contemporary will be sharing your work, and additionally, I will be selecting a handful of artists who will be chosen for an exclusive interview on this podcast, the Artist Mother podcast, and select artists will also be featured in New Visionary magazine. So there's lots of opportunities for promotion within this exhibition. This opportunity is open to artists who identify as parents and caregivers based in the United States. We welcome artists of all career levels to apply, and we accept all 2D and 3D mediums, including painting, drawing, photography, digital, prints, fiber art, collage, mixed media, sculpture, ceramics, and installation art. Unfortunately, we are not accepting film or video at this time due to the gallery's limitations. I'm thrilled to share this exhibition in partnership with Victoria at Visionary Art Collective. You can head to artistmotherpodcast.com/exhibitions To learn more, hit our exhibitions tab on our homepage or go to the Visionary Art Collective page and find the submission form there. We would love to see your work and to maybe meet up in New York City. That would be so amazing. So make sure you apply by our deadline, Sunday, December 1st, 2024 at midnight. Hope to see your work, hope to see your submission, and hope to see you in New York City in April 2025. Well, let's dig into the process a little bit more in terms of like actual structure of making the book. Based on your bio, I know you do a lot of writing, but I'm not sure if you had published a book prior to this one. No.
This is my first book.
Yeah. So like, I guess my first question that I want to ask you related to this, and I hope you don't mind this question, but how did you feel so brave to say, I'm going to write a book? Like, I'm going to do this. Like, that feels like, because I've had book ideas, and like, certainly there's part of me that's like, just the time thing. Like, I'm just like, I'm not willing to like prioritize time to do that. But there's also this part of me that's like, nah, somebody else will write that. Like, it's not going to be me. Like, it feels like, wow, to just like commit and say, no, I'm going to be the person who's going to write this book. Like, I'm like in awe of your bravery a bit of like making that decision.
Yeah. So I've trained as a writer since college and the master's program. So though I've done other work to get paid because it's extremely hard to make a living as a writer. So I've held these other jobs, but I always have thought of myself as a writer and
a creative writer,
Yeah.
So you kind of always knew it was maybe within you.
Yeah, I knew I would write books. I think over the course of my 20s, I developed a real confidence in my voice uniquely, and received a lot of positive feedback about the unique thing that I was doing. I'm not a fiction writer. My voice is lyrical and very personal and embodied and emotionally evocative. So there are lots of ways to be a great writer. And I found a lot of confidence in one specific voice as a and so though I did have some insecurities because I'm not trained as a visual artist about why should I write this book?
Right.
I had become more confident in my ability to do good research. I was working at an art museum, and so I was surrounded with curators and art historians and was just like really excited to be learning their language. And then I knew that I would write this book in a way that nobody else could, not because I'm an art historian or an expert about the art, but because of that voice that I was talking about, that kind of embodied, emotionally evocative voice. And what better way to write about motherhood than in a way that pays very close attention to the body and very close attention to layers of emotion. And so the book weaves together a personal narrative about my coming into motherhood with biography and studies of the work of these other artists. And I tried as much as I could to bring that voice to their stories as well. So rather than just giving like a Wikipedia explanation of their lives, I tried to bring readers into the moment of like when Ruth Asawa was planting fruit-bearing trees in her California home.
I love the reflections on Ruth Asawa.
That was one of my favorite chapters to write because she's just like, there's so much richness surrounding her life and her family.
Yeah. I think that term embodiment or embody is definitely for me one of like the strengths of the book, in that I can tell a mother wrote this, you know, because I think artist mothers, like, there's so much that we have to say about, you know, what our body goes through, not necessarily in pregnancy, certainly that's part of it, but just as a parent, you know, the ways in which your body is pushed and challenged, and the things that you change your mind about because of that. So I think that is definitely a strength of the book, and I can feel that for sure. So let's talk a little bit about the process. Did you, you know, from the day that you were like, Eureka, I'm going to write this book, what happened? Like, did you, and also you have a publisher, it's published by Broadleaf Books out of Minneapolis. And so, like, did you go straight to, I need a publisher, I need some money, I need some whatever? Or were you like, let me just work up the first draft and we'll see where this goes? Like, what was kind of the nuts and bolts process?
Yeah. I wrote two chapters of this book just as standalone essays during the COVID lockdown. Mm-hmm. I had a 9-month-old. The museum where I was working was doing this really amazing show of contemporary artists in Philadelphia. And there were artists in that show whose work I became really interested in. Becky Sess specifically, who does these really amazing large interior scapes. So I started writing these essays, and I wrote two of them, and I really loved them, and I thought, I think there's a book here. But I had previously written a full manuscript of a book about some loss in my immediate family. My dad and my brother had passed away really close to each other, like within 2 years' time, in the years that I was falling in love and marrying my husband. So I had written this whole collection of essays about grief and love, and I had gotten a literary agent to represent me to sell that book to publishers, and nobody wanted it because I didn't have a platform. They were like, we think that the voice is really strong here, but we don't trust that this author has an audience to sell this book to.
I have heard that before about publishing, and it's like, really, is that true?
It's but totally true.
I've heard that it's like, I mean, just like artists, right? Now we have to be marketers and do the things. Like, we can't just make the brilliant art. We gotta know how to sell it.
Yeah, it's such a challenge, and poses like another challenge to the compatibility, I think, of motherhood with artistic practice. But we can talk about that later. Yeah. So I didn't want to write a whole other book and just have it sit on my desktop with nobody who wanted it. So I went to my agent and I said, can we make a proposal for this book, just including two chapters, which is customary when you're sending a book proposal to publishers. You send an introduction and two chapters, and make sure that there's an editor who's interested and can kind of offer feedback and guide me about the kind of book that she would want to work with and want to sell. So I really polished a couple of chapters. I sent it out and received this offer from Broadleaf Books with this amazing editor, Valerie Weaver-Zirker. And then I had 1 year to finish the book.
Okay. So you're like, what did I do?
Okay. I knew that that's how it would be. So yeah. I was prepared, but I had a 2.5-year-old and a 6-month-old or 9-month-old when I got that book contract. So I wasn't sleeping well and was totally consumed in early motherhood, but fortunately I had a really flexible full-time work from home day job, that enabled me to, you know, if I had an hour here or an hour there during the workday when I had childcare, I could work on the book.
And there's just for context, there's 12 chapters. So you had, you had two done ish and then, yeah, there's 12. So you had 10 others to write, but also There's lots of other components, I'm sure, to writing a book, like writing the foreword and making sure the index is like the biography, like all the promotion, the marketing materials. Yeah. Yeah. So lots of work.
You're insightful, though, to think about it in terms of 12 months. So yeah. I made this storyboard on my wall, and each chapter was assigned to a month. Mm-hmm. And I just set the goal for myself that I would finish a chapter a month and then leave myself 2 months for revisions, early readers weighing in on helping me make revisions. Mm-hmm. And yeah, line edits, polishing, mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. I would say the most helpful part of my process was that I would go away for one or two nights each month, ideally toward the beginning, and get like a really strong start on the research and just like cranking out a bunch of words so that in a very focused way and with a full night's sleep and no children interrupting me in between.
You did like mini residencies.
Exactly. Yeah. I just either got an Airbnb or I stayed at the spiritual retreat center where I work with a spiritual director, unrelated to my writing, mostly just about life. Yeah. Once I had that strong start, I had then momentum for the rest of the month when I did have an hour here or 3 hours there, to be able to dip in and out. Mm. Easily.
Because you never know what comes up, right?
That's right. And I just tried to keep my head in the world of that chapter. So if I was going to drive an hour to take my kids to see some friends, I would listen to a podcast about the artist that I was researching that month, or listen to the album by the musician I was writing about that month or whatever. So just little tricks to make it easier to enter and recede and then return to the work.
Mm-hmm. I love that. I love the idea of, well, the residency kind of concept is something that I really believe in. Like I run a virtual residency program. I have like an in-person like I just think residencies in accessible formats for artist parents, which does not look like a traditional commit your life to this one thing for 3 months, right? I'm talking about residencies that are broken up in many different ways to make them accessible. But man, I think they're so important to the creative practice, is like just 24 hours, 48 mm-hmm. hours to get the bulk done. And I love that way that you framed that about kind of, you know, doing the 70% and then allowing yourself the flexibility to dip in and out and to ebb and flow with like the rest of your life. Like, I think that model can be practiced in like so many ways, like meal prep, right? Or like, there's like different ways that we can use that practice that I just think for parents is just like really helpful, because we're not guaranteed, you know, X amount of consistent time. So we have to know how to kind of structure and then dip in and out a little bit here and there, you know?
And that was a big change from my writing practice before kids. Before kids, I was awake at 6 or 6:30 every morning and either writing or reading or doing kind of writing admin. Mm-hmm. For 2.5 hours before my 9-to-5s started. Mm. And then I had kids and there's just no morning anymore. It's mm-hmm. like you are on from the moment that your kid wakes up, which in my family is very unpredictable. Mm-hmm. So to learn that if I have that 70% done, as you said, that I can trust that those pockets of time will come up. They're just going to be unpredictable.
Yeah.
And I can take advantage of them. Also learning that even if I feel really tired and like my brain is not working, and I do not feel anything like a flow state, but I sit down and I do the work and I just try to get some words on the page, I will go back and look at them and be like, whoa, I wrote that when I was feeling that. I think I used to have some kind of preciousness about a clear headspace.
Yeah.
And I don't have that preciousness anymore.
Well, I think a lot of people talk about that as a constraint of parenting, right? Is that we can't just wait around for inspiration to strike. We just have to do the work. And sometimes we really don't feel like doing the work. And, you know, especially as a writer, maybe my perspective on this is different because writing feels hard to me. But, and it's like, you know, it comes after a lot of other things that I want to do, right? Like making a beautiful piece of art. I have to eventually probably write about that art, but that comes after I like make the art. But yeah, sometimes for me, like writing, it really has to be this more intuitive thing. Like I'm just like, I just can't do it sometimes, you know? And I'm sure you experience some of that, but also your dedication to the discipline of it is more similar to what I would feel in just getting in the studio when I don't feel like making something. And then, you know, I just dive in somewhere, even if it means I'm just cleaning my studio. And then I eventually start to make some moves and I go from there, you know?
It's also helpful to like end a session with a little note to myself about what I'm going to do when I start again. Because I think that one of the biggest barriers is that re-entry. And just not know, like if you come to the page not really knowing what you're going to, that can feel overwhelming. But if you come to the page with instructions from your past self, then it can be easier to re-enter.
Artist parents need time and space to create, and they need a platform to share their work. I'm so honored to share this collaborative open call with you, combining the platform of the Artist Mother Podcast and Kinhouse Art in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Artist Mother Podcast and Kinhouse Art seek to provide a supportive environment and nourishing resources to help artists who are parents to thrive. In this open call, two selected artists will receive a one-month exhibition at our gallery for a two-person show, a week-long stay at our artist residency in Fort Wayne, Indiana, which is family-friendly and needs to be used during the 2025 calendar year. Dates are flexible based on your availability. Both selected artists will also receive a personal interview on the Artist Mother Podcast, which will be published in 2025. You'll receive promotion and marketing of your work on both platforms, the Artist Mother Podcast platform and Kinhouse platform. And you'll also receive an opening reception and support for your two-person exhibition on Friday, May 2nd, 2025. As artist parents ourselves, we understand the challenge and complexity involved when you are making art and raising humans. This exhibition and residency opportunity was really created to fit the need for emerging and mid-career artists to have opportunities to make and show their work in inclusive and family-friendly spaces. So this open call is for individual artists to submit on behalf of themselves. We're not asking you to submit as a pair. We want you to submit as individuals, and we will be selecting two artists to feature in our exhibition. And both of those artists will get their own residency week at Kinhouse Residency in Fort Wayne, Indiana. We welcome submissions from persons of all genders and backgrounds, as long as you identify as an artist parent. Please submit work in its finished form. However, we do recognize that the work submitted may not be what you end up exhibiting in May of 2025. Once again, the exhibition opening will take place on Friday evening, May 2nd of 2025. Your attendance at this event is not required. But the residency dates that you will receive are flexible and can be scheduled anytime during the 2025 calendar year. We would love to see your submission. This open call is available at kinhouseart.com. And you can click the open calls tab right at the top and you'll see double duty up there. We would love to see your submission by December 1st, 2024, midnight of Eastern Standard Time. So once again, we would love to see your submission for double duty, an open call for a two-person show, an artist residency for artist parents that is supported by the Artist Mother podcast and Kinhouse Art. One question I had for you is, to me, a book feels so complete. Like, I wrote a book and here is this book that says everything I want to say. You know, but I think that's a capitalist mindset that we get caught up in. And I find myself in the studio feeling that way. Like, I have to put all my good ideas in this one piece. And actually, like, the best artists I know how to be patient and just like trust that there will be another opportunity for your next good idea, you know? I don't know. I was just curious to have you talk a little bit about that feeling of completeness. Like, do you consider your writing practice when your final product is something as like finished, quote unquote, as a book, you know, do you, like, how do you think about that in terms of like what's next for you? Because it's like, I can always make another painting, you know?
Right.
There's never, like, I get stuck in this mindset of I want to put all the good ideas in the one painting, but really I can make another one. Mm-hmm. But a book is like, it's a book. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. Maybe I have some like weird complex around capital B books, but.
Yeah. I think like the question of whether or not this book was complete was less about like getting all the ideas in and more about a goal that I had set for myself toward the beginning of starting it, which was that the writing of this book would make me a more attentive and loving mother to my own children and to the children of strangers. I received advice from this wonderful writer and teacher, Sarah Centillis, that as you begin a book and you have all of these hopes and dreams for like Oprah picking it up to be part of her book club and selling a certain number of copies or having a New York Times review, that to ground yourself in the writing process, you should set a goal for a more personal goal, maybe about how it will form you, maybe about how it will form your reader. And so that is what I wrote kind of at the top of my storyboard on my wall. And I just had that up there. And I thought if 25 people read this book, but the writing of it made me a better human, a better mother, and a better member of my community, then this work will be complete. So of course there are lots of questions we could ask about. Did I include all of the people that I should have included in this book? Did I miss some amazing mother artists that really should be in the book or some big concept? But I do feel like I said what I wanted to say. And I love all of the women that made it into the book. And first and foremost, I feel like the reflective work that I did in the writing has just made me a more attentive mother to my kids and more respectful of others' children, in the sense that everybody was a baby once. Every person is worthy of the attention and affection and curiosity that we stare at little babies with. Whether they're grown or someone else's kid on the playground.
I'm definitely going to be carrying that with me for a while. I feel like it reminds me of something my friend Sarah Irvin said, which I reference a lot. But instead of thinking of the work that I can't make because of motherhood, what is the work that I can only make because of this experience?
Yes.
You know, like, I feel like that's a similar way of framing it, is like not seeing it as a limitation, but as, you know, something that can help you be the kind of person you want to be. Like, how can your art do that? And I know some people listening to this might say, like, that's putting a lot of expectations on your art, but really it's how we're spending our time. You know, like, it's about the process. Like, if you're not doing something in the process of being in the studio for 4 hours that is gonna make you the kind of person you want to be, or bring you closer to your kids, or I don't know, it's like, what's the point? Like, what's the priority here? Are we just making shiny objects?
Yeah. Yeah, I think the thesis, or kind of main thing that I hope readers will remember from reading this book, is that the world needs the work that only mm-hmm. mothers can make. Mm-hmm. If we really believe that art has the power to change the world, change minds, move people on a deep level, then the world and our communities need art that's made by those who spend most of their time staring at and caring for the vulnerable ones of this world. Mm. And that when mothers are absent from the making of culture, the world loses that unique perspective.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I have one more question for you as we move towards ending this. This has been so enriching. Curious from a listener perspective who is like, dang, I want to be included in a book like that someday. Just if you have any like thoughts or advice towards artists who may want their work to be written about, you know, like both in practical, like, here's how I found some of the artists that I wrote about, and also a bit more, you know, idea based in like, these are some of the things that are really compelling, that are easy to write about, or that are interesting to write about. Any thoughts on that question?
Yeah, I think the artists who present to the world like a pretty clear and strong reading of their own work is really helpful for a writer then has kind of an on-ramp.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if your work is conceptual in any way. There's some work that I write about because staring at it just like brings me so much joy, and I want to somehow like mediate that experience to a reader. And then there's other work, like I think of the work of Senga Nangudi, who has this whole series of works that use pantyhose and like stretch it in weird ways to talk about the elasticity of the female form.
Mm-hmm.
Her work, like looking at it, is more like puzzling and intriguing, but it's not necessarily for me an experience of like, I feel awash with beauty.
Right.
But because she's making work that she and others have interpreted a little bit for me and have told me a little bit how to come to it, then now I'm like fascinated and I want to learn everything I can about her and her story, and then do some of that interpretive work myself as well.
Practically, what does that on-ramp look like? You described it as like an on-ramp. Like I know like of what
statement. That's your website. That's
having good writing that accompanies
the marketing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you're a visual artist and you have a writer friend, ask them to spend some time with you and interview you and take your vision and articulate it, Not extensively. It could just be a paragraph. Mm-hmm. But I think that that gives other writers something to start with. Mm-hmm. I think that's true. So I mentioned that I was working at the Philadelphia Museum of Art curating this concert series. And that was true in booking too. Mm-hmm. I wanted great music. So again, like I wanted to feel that awash with beauty. Mm-hmm. But I also wanted a story to tell. Mm-hmm. So if there was a great band that just had great music and a great man with great music and a compelling story of some kind that they had pithily explained on their website, I might go with them.
Yeah. Great advice.
So that's all really practical.
Yeah. But it's really good advice. Writing about your work and having writing about your work matters.
Yeah.
And if you're not at a place where other people are writing about you, then have your peers write about you. Make sure your writing about your work is good, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So. I think of this artist space in the 70s and 80s, just above Midtown, that Linda Good Bryant founded in New York. And it was a space mostly for Black artists, although they were very inclusive. And part of why that space succeeded was because they wrote about each other's work. Mm. And they like really relied on this network of other creatives outside of the visual art space to write interpretive material about their work and to publish it in major magazines and newspapers. And then they also published a number of books about their shows.
Awesome. Okay. Well, final five. I always close these interviews with just some quick questions for folks to get to know you. I feel like this first one is going to be especially hard for you because you wrote a book about so many of your favorite artists, but who is your biggest art crush? This can just be of the moment.
Aubrey Leventhal.
Oh, you had it answer. There you go.
Philly-based, beautiful, beautiful painter.
Yes. Okay. What is your favorite place to travel or a dream trip you'd like to go on?
I want to go back to my honeymoon in Saint-Paul-de-Vence, France.
Oh, that sounds pretty good. Tell me about a film or a book that has been a big inspiration to you.
The Tree of Life, Terrence Malick's film, so beautifully encapsulates questions about moral development and life and death.
Okay, and what is your favorite meal?
Tomato basil mozzarella salad.
Ooh, good one. Okay, shout out time. Anybody you want to recognize for supporting you and your work?
My husband, Austin Ricketts. Couldn't have written this book without him.
Okay, and where can folks find more of you? Where can they buy the book? Where can they connect with you?
I am on maternity leave right now from the internet, but when I'm back in action, you can find me on Instagram. That's where I hang out a lot. And you can buy the book
at Catherine Ricketts, Catherine.Ricketts.
It's at by Catherine Ricketts.
By Catherine Ricketts. That's right.
And then you can buy the book wherever you buy books. You can go to your local bookstore and ask them to order it for you. You can go to your local library and ask them to order it for you, or you can get it on Amazon and it'll arrive in 2 days.
Yes. And that is such a cool thing to say. You can get my book wherever books are sold. I love that. Awesome, Catherine. Thank you so much. This has been a really enriching and nourishing conversation for me. So I appreciate you. And I appreciate you doing this amazing work of writing about artist parents. This book is a great thing to gift to your friends, people. So there's my endorsement. Thank you.
Thanks, Kaylin. So good to talk with you. And thanks for all the work that you do, too.
Thank you.
The Artist Mother podcast is curated and produced by Kaylin Butine. Music by Josh Middleton. Editing and mixing by John M. Butine. please visit www.artistmotherpodcast.com for episode notes and to find out how you can further support this podcast.